All right, Alexander, we have got to talk about Prime Minister, the chief manager of Tsar Nicholas's government, and that is Stolypin. And he has been brought in to manage things. And he has done, I would say, a pretty incredible job, it looks like. How would you rate his performance so far, given that we are 1908 right now? And all signs are showing that the economy is taking off, is ready to take off. The culture, the arts, everything seems to be on an upswing. But there's trouble. There's still a lot of radical forces mulling around and trying to work their regime change goals into the picture. But Stolypin has proven to be a very effective administrator and manager. Is that true or not true?
Absolutely true. Now, I think the first thing to say is, of course, that the Tsar has had found it very difficult to find people that he can rely upon. One of the things he learned after the 1904 to 7 political crisis in Russia, the one which started with the Japanese War, and we had the 1905, 1906 turmoil, which some people call the 1905 revolution. He had two disastrous experiments with the Duma, which, as I said, became liberal dominated, and he also found that he had all kinds of difficulties within his own family. He found it very difficult to find people whom he could rely upon, and he's also found that he can't really trust many people. And that's, by the way, having a very corrosive effect. We're going to come to that in a moment. We're going to discuss how mistrustful the Tsar has become of many of the people around him. But he has found, finally, one person who does seem to be both extremely capable and extremely tough, and that is Mr. Stolypin. Now, Mr. Stolypin is, on the one hand, somebody who is prepared to take the hard administrative police measures that the situation required in order to stabilize the situation. But he's also somebody who has a way of looking forward. He actually has a plan, and it's a plan that many people seem to be prepared to work with. Now, let's take the starting point. When we did our last program, we've just had the third Duma appointed. There was a huge amount of criticism, both of the Tsar and of Stolypin, for the way in which they dissolved the second Duma, rearranged the franchise, and took various steps to bring to create a Duma that they could work with. And we discussed how the radical behavior of the liberals in the second Duma was also alienating them from Russian middle-class society. So we got a third Duma, which is much more conservative than the first two. And the interesting thing to see is that Stolypin has not tried to bypass that Duma. He's managed to work with it. And he's carrying out a whole series of economic and social reforms. And they are reforms that seem to be aimed at reorganizing the situation of the countryside, giving peasants opportunity to own and run and operate their own land. Up to very recently, they were either serfs. I mean, we forget that, within living memory, right up until the 1860s, most Russian peasants were actually serfs. They were technically the property of the land, which was owned by the landowners. I mean, it's an extraordinary state of affairs, but that's what they were. And then when the serfdom was abolished, they were connected in what were called communes, mirs, the so-called mir, which is a sort of communal organization, which owned the land collectively. And what Stolypin is doing is he's making it easier for peasants to set up as private landowners, private landholders themselves. He's also taken a lot of steps to ease the position of commercial agriculture. And we're seeing Russian agriculture starting to prosper. And of course, he's also taken steps within industry. And he's charting forward regulations for health and safety in factories, for inspecting working condition in factories, providing labor rights for people in factories, kind of things that we are quite accustomed to in the West, but which up to now haven't existed to any very great degree in Russia. And all of this is happening against a backdrop of financial and economic stabilization. We discussed in our previous programs how after Russia joined the gold standard, that precipitated an economic recession. That recession now has passed. We look to be in a period of economic boom. The government's tax revenues as a result are increasing, and the government is using some of those tax revenues in various programs, one of which particularly is to expand education in the countryside. So we see a major program to increase rural education, opening up rural schools and things of that kind. So we're actually seeing a overall program which seems to be achieving quite a lot of success against a backdrop of political and economic stabilization. The government has good relations with the Duma, or at least not perhaps entirely good relations, but at least workable relations with the Duma. Duma often criticizes the government. There's often angry words exchanged, but things do tend to work. And at the same time, the government itself is functional. And importantly, at the very center of power, Stolypin and the Tsar seem to have a reasonable working relationship with each other. So it's an overall economic and political stabilization. I would add that it's also happening alongside a revival of the Russian military system that was very badly knocked around as a result of the Russo-Japanese war and, of course, by the political turmoil. But now the army is gradually being reorganized, and there seems to be a general upswing in pretty much every area.
In our last video, we talked about the alliances that have been forming between Russia and the UK and Russia and France. Is that still deepening? Are those alliances deepening?
Yes, it is. And it is one area where I know an awful lot of people in Russia are extremely concerned that Russia is becoming increasingly aligned with the Western powers against Germany, and that there are people, especially of a conservative view, their leader is Mr. Durnovo, who was the interior minister, who basically got on top of the political crisis, the strikes and the protests in the 1905-1906 winter. He is known to be extremely worried that Russia is becoming overly dependent on the West. Now, one of the things that happened was that in 1906, because of the political crisis in Russia, tax revenue basically collapsed. The government was a very real risk of running out of money. And the government, and that included Mr. Stolypin, had to float a bond on the Paris Bourse. In other words, they had to borrow money in France, in Paris. And that was actually very successful. Lots of French and British investors put money, bought up this bond, and it did tide the government through a lot of its political difficulties. But it has meant that the government itself, the Russian government, now finds that it's becoming increasingly tied into the global economic structures that have their centre in the city of London. And that inevitably means that Russia is becoming politically more aligned with the West, the Western powers, against Germany. And there are people like Mr. Durnovo who say this is a dangerous thing, that Russia has no real concern about whether it's Britain or Germany that prevails in this dispute in the West. What Russia needs is peace. The situation, the international situation, is very fraught. And that the danger of aligning so closely with one power bloc against another is that Russia could become drawn into a war, which it has no interest in. And that is a fairly common view, especially in conservative circles in Russia. I would add that another complicating factor is that though the Russian government is having to borrow from the Western powers, remember it's the Western powers, Britain and France, that have the access to the capital. Germany is an industrially highly developed country, but it doesn't have that huge amount of investment capital that Britain and France do. So one paradox is that even as Russia is becoming more indebted to the West, Germany is increasingly becoming Russia's major trade partner. So there is this bizarre problem that on the one hand, the Russians are finding themselves drawn into a political alliance with the Western powers based on their financial needs, even though their strategic and trading needs point instead towards a closer alignment with Germany. And as I said, there are many people in Russia who are becoming extremely worried about this.
Yeah, but can I just ask you a real quick question? Is there a reason why they're worried? I mean, I can understand you don't want to be aligned.
Yeah.
You want to try to be as neutral as possible to safeguard your country's well-being, and you may be wary of alliances. But is there a reason that they're worried about Germany and the UK or Germany and France? I mean, is there a cause for concern?
Yeah. There is a very real cause for concern because German-French relations are very tense. Germany, after the victory in 1870, gained a lot of what was once French territory, and the French have always sought to recapture it. And in fact, there's a policy in France called revanche, and the French government is committed to eventually regaining control of all this territory that was lost to Germany. But beyond that, there is the overriding duel that is now taking place between Britain, which has historically been the world's most powerful country, and Germany, which is the rising power. And the British in particular are seeing Germany's rise as a threat to their preeminent position, and so they're forming alliances in order to contain Germany. And the Germans, for their part, are reacting to this by building up their naval forces, seeing Britain increasingly as an adversary, and we now have the Germans talking increasingly about Weltpolitik, world policy. In other words, they want to take the challenge to Britain, to every part of the world, to Africa, to wherever. So we're seeing increasing tensions between Germany and the Western powers, and the Russians very reluctantly are being dragged into it. And it's something that the Russians don't like at all, but which they find that they're being forced into by their financial needs.
I imagine Germany realizes this too. I'm sure they see that Russia is being drawn into this alliance. So where are they going to turn? They're going to obviously probably turn to,
well,
to their to Austria-Hungary.
Absolutely.
I can't figure out which. Germany's seeing all of this go down as well. They're seeing Russia align with France and the UK, and they're saying, well, we're going to have to make alliances.
Exactly. And I mean, this is a key thing to understand, because until the 1880s, especially when Bismarck was in charge, the Germans tried to maintain some kind of balance in their relations between Austria-Hungary and Russia. Austria and Hungary and Russia do have conflicts over the Balkans, but the Germans were very careful to avoid taking sides. Bismarck once made a famous comment. He said that the Balkans are not worth the bones of a single German soldier. He wanted to keep a balance between the Austrians and the Russians. But with the Russians drifting ever closer to the French and the British, the Germans are starting to feel encircled, and as a result, they're tightening their alliance with Austria, and that means to some extent that they're being drawn into supporting Austrian policies in the Balkans. So it's a difficult and potentially very dangerous situation when you can see that these alliance systems are increasingly beginning to look like drawing up battle lines for a future European war. One which, I stress again, Russia, going through this very complex transition at the moment, has no interest in or desire to become involved in, but which it is increasingly being pulled into. One has to say, however, that for the moment, this need to become close to the Allies, to the Western powers, is clearly there. And one of the things that the Russians are doing, and here we understand Nicholas himself, the Tsar is himself involved. He is, as I said, an educated man. He's very well aware of the fact that Russia is going through a cultural boom. He is organising with one of the officials in the Directorate of Imperial Theatres a massive Russian cultural exhibition in France next year. It's going to be called the Season of the Russian Ballet, Les Saisons de Ballet Russe. The official he's selected is a man called Sergei Diaghilev, and it's not just going to be ballet dancers, it's going to be orchestras, musicians, painters, you name it. It's going to be on a simply gigantic scale. Now, Mr. Diaghilev is somebody who some people in Russia don't trust. And apparently, Nicholas has been told that if he does go to France, he's something of a lone wolf and will try to give the impression that he's doing all this by himself. But in reality and in fact, everybody who's familiar with the situation knows that this is very much Nicholas's idea. He wants to show to the French that Russia is not only a strong country politically, economically, militarily, but that it's also a cultural powerhouse. He knows that France is the centre of European intelligentsia, and he wants to make a big impact. He knows he's got the best ballet company in the world. He knows he's got one of the best opera companies in the world. He knows how advanced Russia is in the visual arts. He knows that the Russians are busy, for example, experimenting in abstract painting and things of that kind, things he doesn't personally like very much himself. But, you know, he's aware about the impact that they're going to have. And he's busy putting together this gigantic exhibition, this gigantic season that he's going to launch on Paris next year. And I predict it's going to be a sensation.
Yeah, there's a lot of great up and coming artists as well in right now in Russia. But I mean, you know, I like these types of initiatives personally. But I also feel that, number one, these types of cultural and social initiatives, especially if you're looking at Nicholas, you know, doing these types of exhibitions and these types of functions with a country like France, for instance, once again, connects those countries even deeper, right? So you create an even deeper connection there. And, you know, everyone knows that Nicholas is very well read. Tsar Nicholas is very well read. He's also very well traveled. I believe he's traveled just about everywhere with,
pretty much,
with
absolutely.
Alexander as well, all over Europe.
Yes.
Do you also fear, the fear that I have with this is, given our last video, do you think there'll be forces inside of Russia? Once again, those the forces, I mean, we mentioned Lenin in our last video, forces like these, which will try to paint Nicholas as being aloof, being disconnected from the working class, being someone who doesn't have an interest in Russia, but is, you know, kind of roaming around Europe and, you know, rubbing elbows with you know, French dignitaries and UK dignitaries. I mean, also Nicholas has ties to, I mean, his family is connected to the UK, to, I believe, Denmark as well. I mean, he is a Tsar with an international exposure, but do you think that can be taken advantage of internally to once again stoke the fires of regime change?
Absolutely, because can I just say, you talked about Lenin. Of course, Lenin himself, one of the paradoxes of the 1905-1907 events is that because he's got the most organized party and because he's far and away, to be straightforward about it, the most intelligent figure by far on the radical left, within that left itself, he has emerged stronger. I mean, I said in our previous program that the Tsarist police forces already put him at the center. I mean, he's politically gaining strength on the left all the time. The other forces that we were talking about, the Socialist Revolutionary Party, the Mensheviks, they are gradually losing traction. And it is Lenin and his Bolshevik party that is actually gaining, because, you see, he's a He's an extremely clever and very good man and very good organizer. He's also, by the way, and this is one of the paradoxes, in the Russian political system, in Russian politics, you mentioned the fact that Nicholas himself is a highly educated man. The other very educated man is Lenin. This is an odd thing, but Lenin and the Tsar actually share an interest and liking of the same writer. They each patronize a Russian writer called Tefi, who's a woman writer who writes short stories. And it's an odd thing to say, but, you know, they have that commonality. There is a view, I know, in Russia that, you know, these are the only two people, along with Stolypin perhaps, who really count for anything in the political system. But Lenin will certainly make the point that the Tsar is becoming aloof from the people. Unfortunately, others will do so as well. They will say to the Russians, well, you see, he's not really interested in you. He's not interested in us. He's interested in what the smart people in Paris think. And that, unfortunately, in Russia, is something that might indeed gain traction. And bear in mind, there are people who whisper about this, even within Nicholas's own family. I said how isolated and mistrustful he's become. He trusts his family and the court so little now that he doesn't even have a secretary, because he's worried that anything he dictates to a secretary could be leaked immediately to the liberal media. So he does all his own paperwork, which is an astonishing thing to think about. You know, the Tsar of all the Russias has to do his own filing and his own paperwork. He's apparently a very orderly man. He does it well, but he's become very mistrustful of his court, of some people in his family, of some of the people around him. And when somebody is so mistrustful, he tends to keep a distance. It's easy to project him as somebody who's aloof and, of course, getting close to the smart people in Paris, even though it's done, as I said, for a very clear political purpose. It's going to make it easier for some people to say that he is aloof and remote from his people, even though, in fact, and in reality, he's very engaged with Russia altogether.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there's any truth to that, but you answered my
question. No, I mean, he's Nicholas is a very strong patriot. I'll give you one example. I mean, he doesn't like being called emperor. I mean, he's one of the official proper title of the Russian ruler is emperor. I mean, imperator. But he doesn't like being called it. He actually likes being called Tsar, because Tsar is a Russian title, and he prefers to be called the Tsar rather than the Emperor. His wife, by the way, Alexandra, for some reason, doesn't like being called the Tsaritsa, the Emperor, the Russian title. She prefers to be called Empress, Imperatrice, but who knows why. But anyway, Nicholas is a deep Russian nationalist, a patriot. And if you look at the kind of artists, we go back to the artists, artistic things. The people he likes, he doesn't like people who go in for abstract art. He's quietly funds an entirely different group of people called the World of Art group, who are people who are deeply concerned about Russia. They sort of have a sort of Art Nouveau style, but very much one that emphasizes Russian folk art, things of that sort. And so he is a deep Russian patriot, somebody who is very absorbed and very interested in conditions in Russia. And it's known that his favourite minister within the Russian government is a man called Krivoshein, who is the agriculture minister who works directly under Stolypin. And Krivoshein is the person who is in charge of setting up all these schools in the Russian countryside. And Nicholas himself is known to take a huge interest in all of that. So he is not actually indifferent to his people at all. That isn't what he's about at all. You can disagree with many of his policies. You can think that sometimes he makes mistakes, but he's certainly not indifferent to Russia or to the fate of the country or to the fate of its people. But it's very easy to see how some people will be able to claim that he is.
Yeah, no, one thing I will say about Nicholas is that it seems that he didn't enjoy the day-to-day administrative part of ruling over Russia. But it seems like he has found the right person who is good at that and enjoys that and can deliver the results in Stolypin. So it seems that you may have a very good team in Nicholas and Stolypin.
This is, you're absolutely right about this. I mean, when Nicholas became Tsar, he was extremely upset. He didn't expect his father, who was an overpowering, dominant personality, a larger-than-life figure,
Alexander
III, and who loved being Tsar, by the way, and loved the job of being Tsar. He didn't want, he was very, very shocked that he would have to take over from his father. And he really doesn't like it. I mean, he doesn't like to make decisions. He finds it sometimes very difficult to make decisions. I mean, he does eventually, but it's well known that he doesn't like the grind. He doesn't like the, you know, day-to-day work. He has found in Stolypin someone that he can delegate that to. But always there is the worry of what happens if anything were to happen to Stolypin. And Stolypin has many enemies, by the way, in the court. It's not by any means, you know, certain that he will be there forever. And of course, if Nicholas loses Stolypin, it's very difficult to see who would take Stolypin's place. I mean, the other person who is perhaps the most intelligent figure within the Russian governmental system is Sergei Vitter. But Vitter, who was the prime minister at the time of 1905, who came up with the original idea of the Duma, Nicholas has completely lost confidence in him. So it's hardly conceivable that he could be reappointed. And, you know, there's nobody else, realistically, that could take Stolypin's place. So he's very dependent on Stolypin. At the moment, the partnership works well. But if it breaks down, well, you know, there could be all kinds of problems. And, of course, it's important to say that the Liberals, who are by far the most, the greatest danger to the functioning of the system at the moment, they're the people who still have control of some of the levers and who are supported by much of the financial oligarchy in Russia. They're still there and they remain as critical of Nicholas as always. We've talked about a culture. I mean, they have their own supporters in the cultural world. To give an example, the director of the St. Petersburg Conservatoire, the composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, who is a very well-known composer in Russia, he's just produced an opera called The Golden Cockerel, which is a vicious attack on Nicholas. I mean, it makes him look like a complete buffoon, and it has allusions in it to Rasputin. And you can see that Rasputin, who's represented in this opera as some kind of a sinister magician, you can see how the Liberals might try and use the fact of Rasputin's presence in the court to discredit Nicholas even further. And, I mean, this is an extraordinary opera. I mean, in musically very advanced, apparently. But already, apparently, it's created some ructions and, you know, the censors are unhappy about this. But the fact that an opera like that could be produced at all shows how liberal society in Russia, the liberal parties, remain completely opposed to Nicholas, completely opposed to the government. As far as they are concerned, the stabilization that's taking place is a bad thing, because it's a stabilization that is happening without them.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, the liberal society and much of the media, the liberal media, they always paint Nicholas as a buffoon and someone who's disconnected from the people. And I think they have a very clear understanding that if they can take out Stolypin, then they could really hurt the Tsar and the government and create a type of power vacuum, because, you know, as you said earlier in the video, there are not many people that the Tsar and his family trust. And so if you can take out Stolypin, you really leave the Tsar isolated.
Absolutely.
And you run into Rasputin, who I think, you know, this is a figure that's been, day by yeah. day, he's making more and more headlines. Yep. People are whispering about this guy. And the fear is that they're going to use him.
Exactly.
This is my fear, that they'll use him to discredit the Tsar even more. And just real quick, Alexander, I got from my sources, I don't know if you know this, but about a year ago, the Tsar was actually summoned by Alexandra to pray for Alexei, because from what I gather, Alexei had some sort of internal hemorrhage. And she summoned Rasputin to pray for him. And oddly enough, Alexei got better the next morning, which is, I'm not saying, you know, Rasputin did anything, or he is this type of mystic or magician, or he has special powers. I'm just saying what I've heard and what's happened, which is that he did pray for Alexei and Alexei got better.
Well, indeed, absolutely. And of course, this has increased his influence within the court and especially over the Empress Alexandra. And if you go back to that opera, you know, by Rimsky-Korsakov that I was talking about, what you have there is a situation where the Tsar is being manipulated by his wife, who is in effect controlled by this magician. And that's the sort of narrative that is being sold increasingly by the liberals, not openly.
That's what the opera is saying?
Absolutely.
That's the theme of the opera.
So, I mean, that's the sort of story. Of course, it's all done like a fairy tale. So, you know, it doesn't mention Nicholas himself, but it talks about a Tsar who's manipulated by his wife, who is in turn controlled by a magician. And of course, everybody knows what this is about. As I said, even though the opera itself is presented as a fairy tale, you know, with all sorts of fairy tale features and very advanced music and all that sort of thing. And of course, none of this appears in the newspapers because, you know, the censors make sure it isn't there. But it is being spread all over society. Now, I personally find it very difficult to say exactly how important and how influential Rasputin himself is at this moment in time. But the fact is that the very fact that he exists is something that some people who want to undermine the government are using. That's what this opera shows. And on top of that, I mean, I know for a fact that Stolypin himself, the prime minister, is extremely worried about the situation and has been talking to the Tsar about it and wants Stolypin removed from the court. But the Tsar feels, apparently, that his wife depends on Stolypin a great depends on Rasputin. The Tsar feels his wife depends on Rasputin a great deal, and there's a rumor that he said to Stolypin that, you know, better Rasputin than, you know, days of distress and hysteria from my wife if she's deprived of the support of this man. So I don't know how important Rasputin is, but you can see how some people, influential people in Russian society, are using the legend, if you like, of him in order to discredit the Tsar and the court and to create ill feeling against them within Russian society. Whilst the economy remains strong, whilst the political situation remains stable, whilst the relationship between between Nicholas and Stolypin remains as it is, I don't think this is a problem. But if any of that changes, well, you could see how some of these stories could actually start to gain traction and might begin to do real harm.
Yeah, I'll go back to what I said. If they manage a way to disengage Stolypin, then the Tsar is in trouble. Very, very quickly, Alexander, what's your take on Rasputin? Do you believe that he healed Alexei?
Well, I don't know. I mean, one point I would make straight away is that Rasputin himself has never claimed to be any sort of healer. That's the one thing about him one could say with some confidence. I mean, he's always claimed to be a person of religious views, somebody with mystical experiences. He's never claimed to have supranormal powers or to have the ability to perform miracles. I mean, that doesn't seem to be what he's about at all. And of course, Alexei does get exceptionally good medical treatment. He's got, you know, access to the best doctors in Russia, and some of those doctors are as good as doctors anywhere in the world. I mean, Russia has exceptionally good medical medical facilities, especially for members of the imperial family. Against that, I have heard this suggestion that Rasputin has a very powerful personality, and the fact that he's known to pray for this boy calms the empress, calms the boy himself, and that might have an effect in helping the boy get over his illness, gives him confidence, makes him feel better, makes him feel calmer, and that actually helps with his treatment. So it's possible that, you know, Rasputin does actually have some actual role. But I do want to stress, if it is a role, I think it's almost certainly a normal one. Rasputin himself does not claim to be any sort of miracle worker. And I think anybody who claims that he does is being, frankly, malicious and is misrepresenting what Rasputin is. You can say all sorts of things about Rasputin. There's all sorts of other rumours about Rasputin. The fact that, unfortunately, he seems to have a very wild side, that he drinks too much, he spends his time in taverns with gypsies.
That's not good.
No, it's not good. It's not a good sight. It's not a good scene at all, and things of that kind. So, I mean, there's that side of him, but the claim that he is some sort of, you know, magician or miracle worker, it's not one he himself has ever made. Just as, of course, the claim that he's a priest or a monk or has been in clerical orders, I mean, that isn't true either, and he's never claimed that.
Yeah, it's like a Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing with Rasputin. For me,
absolutely,
the one side of him is someone who's with the royal family. He's praying over Alexei. He's gotten very close with Alexander, but also the daughters have taken a liking to him as well.
Yeah.
He has a very calming presence in the palace. But then there's the other side of Rasputin that I'm hearing about, which is just this guy's just a party animal.
Absolutely.
An insatiable appetite for all kinds of deviant things.
Exactly.
Which is just not good for the overall picture of the royal family.
Of course not. And you can imagine what people are saying. You can imagine what they're saying about the fact that a person like that is so close to the Tsar's wife and his daughters. Now, I'm not actually suggesting any impropriety, but, you know, if you're maliciously minded, it's not difficult to spread stories like that. And it lends itself to them. And as I said, Stolypin is known to be worried about this and has warned the Tsar about it. And you can see with this opera what the Tsar's opponents are doing about it, too.
Mm-hmm. I'll end the video with one final comment. Stolypin seems to be the glue that's holding everything together. That's my take from listening to you. At least from an administrative standpoint, he's the
absolutely, and of course he gives no time to the liberals. He's not interested. He doesn't show any respect for them. He's very tough on the radicals, the left. I mean, he actually directly runs the police. He's also Minister of Interior as well as Prime Minister. And as I said, he is very tough, very strong-minded, very clear-headed man. He's got a good working relationship with the Tsar. He's very much the person who's holding everything together and pulling it forward. But of course, he's perhaps looking too much like the indispensable man. And that might not be a healthy thing, a healthy situation going forward.
All right, we will leave it there. Take care, everybody. TheDuran.locals.com. Take care.